Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
I was a soldier, then a veteran, a husband, and a father. And with my VA home loan, I'm a homeowner. No down payment required and no PMI. Build your future with the VA home loan. Get what you earn. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for this hyper amount of benefits mentioned here.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're plunging headfirst into something that touches every single one of our lives, often without us even realizing it. Think about it. How many times have you encountered someone who appears to have authority, like maybe a security guard at a concert or a park ranger, even just someone managing a public event?
Right.
And you wondered, what's their actual legal power?
Yeah, that's a common question.
Or maybe you've been in a public place, overheard a really heated argument or witnessed a protest and thought, is that even allowed? Where does free speech end and, you know, a problem begin?
Exactly. Those lines can seem blurry.
So today we're demystifying the very rule books that govern these everyday interactions, especially for you, our curious listener, who might be navigating these situations for the first time.
That's exactly right. For this deep dive, we're taking a close look at two critical legal frameworks that shape daily life, particularly here in Texas.
Okay.
First, the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure. People usually just call it the CCP.
CCP. Got it.
And second, the foundational elements of the U.S. Constitution with a special focus on the Bill of Rights.
Right. The big ones.
These aren't just, you know, abstract legal concepts you skim in a textbook. They are the living documents that define who enforces the law, how they do it, and maybe most importantly, what fundamental rights protect you as a citizen.
So our mission today is to make these essential legal texts accessible and, well, genuinely understandable for anyone, really, regardless of your prior legal background. Think of this as your personal shortcut to being truly well-informed about the rule books of our society and how they apply directly to your life. Whether you're just intensely curious or you want to understand your rights and responsibilities more clearly, this deep dive is designed for you. Let's get started. Okay, let's unpack this with the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure. The CCP. When people hear code, I think they often imagine these long, super complex laws. How should we think about the CCP? What exactly is it, and why is it so important for understanding how justice operates in Texas?
That's a great starting point. The Texas Code of Criminal Procedure is essentially the rule book for the administration of criminal justice in Texas.
The rule book. Okay.
Now, here's a crucial distinction right off the bat.
Yeah.
It doesn't define what a crime is.
Ah.
Instead, it dictates how the system works once a crime is alleged or committed. Think of it as the operational manual for law enforcement's interaction with the public.
The manual. I like that.
Yeah. It lays out the steps, you know, from the very first moments of an incident, like rules for jails and arrests, to how warrants are handled, and even the intricate details of courtroom procedures.
Yeah.
It's the playbook for police, sheriffs, and the courts.
So it's all about the process, the how of justice. And I know this code has been around for a while, right? It's not some brand new set of rules he just cooked up.
That's spot on. The Code of Criminal Procedure actually became effective way back on January 1st, 1966.
Wow.
Yeah. Its enduring nature really speaks to its foundational role in Texas's legal system.
Yeah.
Of course, it's been updated and amended countless times over the decades.
Sure. Things change.
To reflect new laws and societal changes. But its core principles remain pretty steadfast.
Now, you just touched on something really important that I think often causes a lot of confusion. The difference between the CCP and the penal code.
Yes.
Can you break that down for us? Because I think understanding this distinction is absolutely fundamental for our listeners.
It absolutely is.
Right.
This is probably one of the most crucial points for anyone trying to get a clearer picture of our legal system. Let's use a simple analogy. If you think of our entire justice system as, say, a complex machine.
Yeah, a machine.
Texas Penal Code, often just called the PC.
Right, the PC.
That's the blueprint.
Yeah.
It defines what the machine is designed to do.
So the penal code is the what? What exactly does it define?
Precisely. The penal code's objectives are clearly laid out in its opening sections. Its main goal is to ensure public safety.
Makes sense.
It does this by defining what constitutes a crime. providing, you know, fair warning of prohibited actions and their consequences. It also aims to ensure that penalties are proportionate to the offense, and it considers individual differences for rehabilitation.
Okay.
Importantly, it explicitly safeguards conduct that isn't criminal.
Oh, that's good too.
And it guides and limits the discretion of officials to prevent arbitrary or oppressive treatment. So, in short, the penal code tells you what acts are crimes and what the consequences are for committing them.
That's a really clear distinction. So if the penal code is the blueprint that defines the crime, what then is the code of criminal procedure? How does it fit into that machine analogy?
Okay, so if the penal code is the blueprint, then the code of criminal procedure is the procedural manual for operating that machine.
The manual, okay.
It's all about the how of justice. Its objectives are things like preventing crime, ensuring that offenders cannot escape justice, guaranteeing fair and impartial trials with minimal delay, and conducting thorough investigations that bring all relevant evidence forward for either conviction or acquittal. And finally, it dictates how lawful sentences are carried out.
So the CCP tells law enforcement and the courts how they must go about their business, the precise steps they need to follow within the framework of the law defined by the penal code.
Exactly. It's the step-by-step guide.
That makes so much sense. One defines the boundaries of illegal actions, and the other defines how law enforcement must operate when someone crosses those boundaries. It's like one says, don't drive too fast, and the other says, here's the proper procedure for a police officer to pull you over, issue a ticket, and maybe handle your arrest if you don't comply.
That's a perfect way to put it. That really clarifies it.
Yeah, that helps me a lot.
It truly is that fundamental distinction.
Yeah.
And this distinction becomes even more vital when we talk about who is actually putting these procedures into practice.
Ah, the who. So who are these peace officers the Code of Criminal Procedure refers to? When most people hear peace officer, their mind probably goes straight to like a city police officer or a county sheriff.
Right, the obvious ones.
But the CCP defines this role much, much more broadly, doesn't it? My initial assumption about who has law enforcement authority might be way off base.
You're absolutely right to question that assumption. The Code of Criminal Procedure provides an incredibly extensive list that goes far beyond what most people imagine.
Okay.
Yes, it certainly includes the familiar figures, sheriffs, their deputies, constables, city police officers, and marshals, along with their reserves.
Right, the standard ones.
But it quickly expands from there. You'll find municipal park and recreation patrolmen, county park rangers.
Park rangers, okay.
And various types of arson investigators, whether they work for the city, county, state, or even for emergency services districts.
Wow, already more than I thought. Are there even more surprising ones on this list? Like, who else counts?
Oh, without a doubt. The list continues with state fire marshal officers, Texas Department of Public Safety, DPS rangers and officers.
TPS, sure.
And Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission, TABC agents.
TABC agents, okay, yeah. Interesting.
It also includes investigators working for criminal district attorney's offices and county attorney's offices.
So the DA's investigators.
Yep. You'll also find peace officers commissioned by the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission.
Okay, game wardens and such.
Airport police officers in larger cities, or those commissioned by political subdivisions operating commercial airports.
Airport police,
And even Texas Racing Commission officers.
Racing Commission, for horse races and stuff.
That's right.
So if I'm at the airport, that security person might actually be a commissioned peace officer with full authority, not just, you know, a private security guard. That's a genuine surprise for many, I bet.
It can be, yeah. And it gets even more specific.
What other surprising ones make the list?
You also have transit authority officers.
Like for buses or trains?
Ah, yeah.
Exactly. Investigators for the Texas Medical Board and State Board of Dental Examiners.
Wow. Medical and dental boards.
Yep. Hospital district officers, attorney general investigators, even the controllers, commissioned security officers and investigators.
The state tax agency.
Uh-huh. Water control and improvement district officers, and various security officers and investigators commissioned under the occupations, education, general services, and government codes.
It sounds like almost any state agency with an enforcement arm could potentially have peace officers. That's a lot of people.
That's a very fair assessment.
Yeah.
The list also includes appellate court officers, Commission of Insurance investigators, Texas Private Security Board investigators.
Okay.
Juvenile Justice Department's apprehension specialists, inspectors, and investigators, and even Texas Department of Criminal Justice officers and investigators of the Texas Commission on Law Enforcement, or TCOE-LE.
T. Coley, the training commission.
The very same. So, The core insight here is that you simply cannot assume who does or doesn't have law enforcement authority based on their uniform or, you know, common perception.
Right.
From a specialized airport police officer to a, well, a cattle raiser's special ranger, the actual peace officer definition in Texas is vastly broader than most people imagine.
That's huge.
It means a surprising number of individuals have the power to arrest you or enforce state law, and it's crucial for citizens like you to recognize this breadth of authority.
That's a huge takeaway already. It really changes my perception, and I imagine many listeners, of who you might encounter with law enforcement authority. Now, beyond that general list, I understand there are even more specialized peace officer roles with unique powers and limitations.
That's right.
Can you walk us through some of those nuances? Because not all peace officers have the exact same powers, right? It's not like they all have identical jobs.
You're absolutely right. It's definitely not a one-size-fits-all authority. These specialized roles really highlight how specific legal authority can be carefully carved out.
Okay, like what?
First, we have railroad peace officers. The director of DPS can appoint up to 250 of these officers.
Uh-huh.
They are employed by a railroad company, and importantly, the company assumes all liability for their actions.
The railroad pays and takes the risk.
Correct. And the crucial limitation for them is that they cannot issue traffic citations.
No speeding tickets.
But they possess all other peace officer powers. This really illustrates how private entities can be granted public enforcement powers, but with very specific carve-outs.
So they can arrest someone for trespassing on railroad property, but not give me a speeding ticket if I'm on a public road next to the tracks. That's a clear line.
Exactly.
Good.
Next, consider adjunct police officers. These are typically found in counties with populations under 200,000.
Smaller counties.
Right. A chief of police or a sheriff can appoint up to 50 such officers who are commissioned under the education code. Their jurisdiction is quite limited. It's typically restricted to private institutions of higher education. Think private colleges or universities and immediately adjacent areas. Usually within 1 mile of the campus perimeter, if those areas are primarily inhabited by students or employees.
Okay.
They have all police powers, but only within these defined areas, and they are not entitled to state compensation or retirement benefits. This is an important detail for understanding the authority of campus security on private university grounds.
So they're essentially campus police with a very specific, limited scope. Makes sense. What about tribal lands? That seems like another unique jurisdiction.
It is. For tribal peace officers, specifically those associated with the Alabama Coushatta and Kickapoo tribes, their tribal councils have the authority to hire and commission peace officers to enforce all state laws within tribal boundaries.
State laws, okay.
They are vested with full peace officer powers, privileges, and immunities, including the ability to enforce traffic laws. Their powers can even extend outside their direct tribal jurisdiction if they are summoned by or actively assisting another law enforcement agency. A key requirement for them is that they must file a $1,000 bond, which acts as a sort of financial guarantee payable to the governor, and they can be sued upon this bond by injured parties.
A bond.
They are not entitled to normal state peace officer benefits, but they must meet the same minimum qualifications as other peace officers. This really shows a fascinating blend of tribal sovereignty and state law enforcement authority.
That's a truly unique intersection of jurisdictions, very different from a typical police department.
Oh.
What about federal agents? Are they considered Texas peace officers? This seems like a common point of confusion.
This is a particularly crucial point to understand. Special investigators, as they're often referred to in state law, who are typically U.S. federal agents, are generally not Texas peace officers in the same way a city police officer or sheriff's deputy is.
Oh, okay.
Their powers of arrest, search, and seizure for state offenses are typically limited to state felonies only.
Felonies only, that's key.
Yes. This broad category includes special agents from agencies like the FBI, the Secret Service, Customs, ATF, DEA, the Postal Service, IRS, Naval Investigative Service, and the U.S. Marshals Service, among many others.
So a federal agent can't just enforce any Texas law they encounter. Like, they can't give me a ticket for a broken taillight. Their authority is much more specific.
Correct. Their authority within state jurisdiction is often quite specific and limited. However, there are varied authorities for certain federal roles that listeners should be aware of.
Okay, like what?
For example, Federal Protective Services, special policemen, the ones you see guarding federal buildings, they actually have powers of arrest, search, and seizure for any state offense they encounter on federal property.
Any offense? Wow.
Uh-huh. Customs and Border Protection officers, Border Patrol, and immigration agents at Mexican border checkpoints or other entry locations can enforce specific Texas Penal Code sections related to intoxication offenses like public intoxication or DWI.
Interesting. PI and DWI specifically.
Yes. Officers of the National Park Service and United States Forest Service can enforce any state offense within their respective park areas or National Forest System lands.
Okay, in their parks.
Security personnel at commercial nuclear power plants have specific arrest and search powers at the plant site or agreed areas around it. And Secret Service agents have authority for any state or federal law when they are on protection detail or investigating a threat related to their protective duties.
Got it.
Understanding these precise limits is vital for knowing the scope of federal authority within a state.
That's a lot of nuance right there. It really highlights that authority isn't always as straightforward as it seems. What about officers crossing state lines? Can a Louisiana officer just come into Texas and exercise their authority?
That's another area with strict limitations. Peace officers from adjoining states have the same powers, duties, and immunities as Texas peace officers, only under very specific circumstances.
Like what? Emergencies?
Sort of. It includes when they are in physical custody of inmates, transporting them to or from a medical facility within a bordering county, or maintaining custody during an escape.
Okay, prisoner transport.
They also have these powers if they are regularly assigned and on duty to a bordering county, parish, or municipality, and they're operating within 1 mile of that municipality's boundary, and they're authorized by a vote in an open meeting to enforce local ordinances.
Wow, that's very specific.
It is. It really underscores how tight the limits are on cross-border law enforcement authority.
So basically, my neighbor from Oklahoma, who's a cop, can't just come to Texas and pull me over unless they fit one of those very specific, pretty rare criteria.
That's generally correct, yes.
That's reassuring. What about other highly specialized roles? Any others we should know?
Next, we have Special Rangers of the Texas and Southwestern Cattle Raisers Association.
Cattle raisers? Like cowboys?
Sorta. The DPS director can appoint up to 50 of these special rangers, primarily for investigations related to livestock theft and related property crimes.
Cattle rustling.
Exactly. Their powers are strictly limited to offenses involving livestock or related property. Importantly, they cannot issue traffic citations, nor are they entitled to state peace officer benefits, although they must meet minimum peace officer training standards.
Okay.
The association itself is legally liable for their actions and omissions. This is another clear example of specialized, limited authority tied to a very specific economic protection.
Okay, so these are like very specific detectives for cattle rustling, perhaps a modern take on an old problem. Fascinating. And finally, what about school marshals? They've been a topic of much discussion lately, and there seems to be a common misconception about their role.
Yes, and this is a crucial note to clarify. School marshals are not full peace officers.
Not full peace officers. Okay.
Their authority is very specific and limited. They may make arrests and exercise peace officer authority only when it's absolutely necessary to respond to serious bodily injury or death offense threats that occur on school premises.
Only for immediate serious threats.
That's the key. They cannot, for instance, enforce traffic laws or handle general disciplinary issues. They are also subject to specific written regulations adopted by the school's governing body and are not entitled to state peace officer benefits like standard peace officers.
Got it.
This distinction is vital for school communities to understand their specific role, especially in high-stakes situations like active threats.
So they're trained and authorized to respond to emergencies, but they aren't, say, writing speeding tickets in the school zone or dealing with everyday discipline. That clears up a lot of common misunderstandings.
Thankfully, yes.
Now that we know who peace officers are, across this incredibly broad spectrum, what are their core duties and powers? What do they actually do on an everyday basis that impacts our lives?
That's an excellent transition, because while the definitions of who can be a peace officer are broad, their fundamental responsibilities are quite specific. Their primary duty is to preserve the peace in their jurisdictions.
Preserve the peace.
This involves several key actions. First, they are legally empowered to prevent or suppress crime and arrest offenders without a warrant when justified.
Right.
Second, they must execute all lawful processes, which means orders or warrants issued by a magistrate or court.
Serve warrants, okay.
Third, they are required to notify magistrates of offenses within their jurisdiction when they have good reason to believe a crime has occurred.
Report crimes.
And fourth, they have the duty to take possession of missing children. These are the fundamental expectations for any law enforcement officer in maintaining public order.
Those seem like the core responsibilities we'd expect, but there's also a specific provision about immigration status inquiries, isn't there? That seems like a very nuanced and potentially sensitive area.
It is indeed, and it's addressed directly in the Code of Criminal Procedure. Peace officers may inquire into the nationality or immigration status of victims or witnesses during a crime investigation, but only if it is absolutely necessary to investigate the specific offense at hand, or if it's needed to provide the victim or witness with information on federal visas available for those cooperating with law enforcement, like a U visa.
So it's definitely not a blanket right to ask about immigration status then? They can't just ask anyone anytime?
Precisely. And this is where the critical exceptions come in. This power does not apply if the peace officer is conducting a separate crime investigation involving that victim or witness, or if the officer has probable cause that the victim or witness has committed a separate criminal offense.
Ah, okay, so it has to be directly related to the crime they're investigating right now.
Exactly. This provision is a delicate balance. It allows for legitimate investigative needs, but aims to protect victims and witnesses from unrelated inquiries that could deter them from coming forward and reporting crimes. It's designed to prevent inquiries that aren't directly relevant to the specific crime being investigated.
That's a really important distinction, ensuring that someone isn't, you know, potentially punished for seeking help or reporting a crime. What about accountability for officers if they don't perform their duties? Are there consequences for neglecting their responsibilities?
Accountability is indeed addressed. If an officer willfully refuses or neglects to execute a legal process for a witness or any other legal duty, they can face a civil contempt fine. This fine ranges from $10 to $200.
Okay, not huge, but it's something.
Right. This fine is enforced as civil contempt, demonstrating that officers are held accountable for fulfilling their duties as prescribed by law. It's not just a suggestion. There are legal repercussions.
So there are actual consequences for not doing their job. And the sheriff, specifically, has a very unique and broad role, don't they, compared to other peace officers?
Yes. The sheriff's role is quite distinct and comprehensive. Each sheriff shall, for their county, act as a conservator of the peace.
Conservator of the peace. Sounds important.
It is. This means they are required to arrest all state law offenders they observe committing crimes, or those they have good reason to believe have committed an offense. They must take them before a proper examination or trial court.
Oh, okay.
They are also responsible for apprehending and committing to jail all offenders until an examination or trial can be held. And a key part of their role is to quell and suppress all assaults and batteries, affrays, insurrections, and unlawful assemblies.
Quell and suppress sounds very proactive.
It highlights the sheriff's broad, proactive role in countywide public safety, going beyond just reacting to crimes.
That sounds like a heavy responsibility for the county. And linked to that, the custody of prisoners, that's also primarily the sheriff's duty, for example, running the county jail.
Correct. The responsibility for jailed prisoners held by warrant falls specifically to the sheriff.
Yeah, right.
It's actually a violation for a sheriff to permit these prisoners to remain out of jail except when they are out on bail. The sheriff must also give an arrested individual a reasonable time to procure bail and must diligently guard the accused to prevent any escape. This defines the sheriff's primary responsibility for the county jails and the individuals awaiting trial.
So the sheriff is literally in charge of the county jail. And lastly, what about deputies? Can they perform all these duties or are they just assistants?
The Code of Criminal Procedure clarifies that a sheriff's duties may indeed be performed by their deputy.
Okay.
And if there is no sheriff in office, the duties fall on the officer legally empowered to discharge the sheriff's duties. This clarifies the delegation of authority within a sheriff's department, ensuring continuous operation even in the absence of the elected sheriff.
That wraps up our dive into the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure, outlining who peace officers are and how the system is supposed to run in Texas. That was really illuminating. But now, let's zoom out a bit, because these state laws operate within a much larger foundational framework, the U.S. Constitution, which is the ultimate foundation of all our freedoms. To truly understand our rights, we have to go back to the beginning, right? The U.S. Constitution wasn't just pulled out of thin air. It emerged from a very specific and, well, pretty dramatic historical context. So what's the origin story here? why did we need a new constitution in the first place?
The story really begins with profound dissatisfaction and a growing sense of injustice among the American colonists.
Uh-huh.
They felt that the king was denying them what they considered their historic rights as free English citizens. They held a powerful belief that law was superior to any government, even the king himself.
Law over the king. That's radical.
That radical idea that laws could bind rulers was a fundamental driver of their rebellion.
So they weren't just fighting for independence, like we want our own country. They were fighting for the recognition of what they believed were pre-existing fundamental rights.
Precisely. This conviction led to significant action. In September 1774, delegates from 12 colonies met at the First Continental Congress.
Okay.
Their primary purpose was to petition England for their fundamental rights. The right to life, liberty, and property, the right to a trial by jury, the right to peaceably assemble, and the right to have their grievances actually considered.
And how did that go?
Well, the critical turning point, the spark that truly ignited the revolution, was the king's flat rejection of their appeals.
He just said no.
Pretty much.
And that rejection led to even bolder moves, like the Mecklenburg resolves, right? This wasn't just happening in one place.
Yes, the spirit of independence was definitely spreading. In May 1775, just before the full Declaration of Independence, Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, took a remarkably bold step.
What did they do?
They declared the laws of Parliament to be null and void within their county and proceeded to establish their own local government. They were essentially declaring independence for themselves, predating the collective move by the colonies.
Wow, ahead of the curve. And then, of course, the big one. July 4, 1776, the Declaration of Independence. That document wasn't just about breaking away. It laid out the philosophical basis for our government and our rights, didn't it?
It was truly revolutionary, a statement that resonated then and continues to resonate today. The Declaration didn't just state that the 13 colonies were free.
Right.
It justified that independence with those iconic words. Quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness."
The famous words.
The statement fundamentally established the principles of individual rights and self-governance that would later underpin the Constitution. It articulated that government's legitimacy came from securing these inherent rights for its citizens.
So after declaring independence, they tried to set up a government. But the first attempt, the Articles of Confederation, didn't quite work out as planned, did it?
No, not at all.
Why was that? What went wrong?
The Articles of Confederation, adopted in 1778, was indeed our nation's first constitution. However, it suffered from critical weaknesses that made it pretty unsustainable and demonstrated the urgent need for a stronger central government.
Like what kinds of weaknesses?
Well, imagine trying to run a country where the central government couldn't even collect taxes.
No taxes? How do you pay for anything?
Exactly. Couldn't establish a unified currency or maintain and pay an army?
Oh, wow.
It also lacked the authority to regulate foreign or interstate commerce, and it couldn't effectively resolve disagreements between states. It was basically a recipe for chaos and disunity.
Yeah, sounds like it.
It powerfully demonstrated that a strong, capable central government was absolutely necessary for the nation to survive and thrive.
That sounds like a disaster waiting to happen. No wonder they realized they needed to go back to the drawing board entirely. That brings us to the Constitutional Convention.
Exactly. The Constitutional Convention met in Philadelphia from May 25 to September 17, 1787. Their original goal was actually just to revise the Articles of Confederation.
Just tweak it a bit.
Right, but they quickly realized that was insufficient and a completely new constitution was necessary.
Mm-hmm.
The delegates famously agreed to keep their discussion secret throughout the process.
Why secret?
Well, it was a crucial decision at the time to prevent premature public reaction or state interference during the sensitive drafting process. Keep things focused.
Makes sense. And even after they drafted it, getting it ratified wasn't easy, was it? I remember something about a crucial missing piece that almost derailed the whole thing.
You're exactly right. Ratification was a significant challenge, taking 10 months for the first 9 states to approve. A major sticking point was indeed the absence of a Bill of Rights.
Ah, the Bill of Rights.
Many states and their citizens were deeply wary of a strong central government without explicit protections for individual liberties. The promise to add a Bill of Rights as the very first order of business for the new government was key to securing enough votes for ratification.
So they had to promise it to get it passed.
Essentially, yes. This initial struggle and the later inclusion of amendments highlights the Constitution's adaptable nature, allowing it to govern a population that has grown from about 4 million at its inception to over, what, 330 million today?
So the Bill of Rights was basically a deal breaker for many states, showing incredible foresight on their part. And that new constitution established three distinct branches of government. Why was that structure so important? Why not just one powerful branch, like a king?
Well, the framers were deeply, deeply wary of concentrated power, a direct lesson from their experience with the British monarchy and, frankly, the failed Articles of Confederation.
Right. They'd seen the problems.
They intentionally established three distinct branches, legislative, executive, and judicial, to prevent any single entity from becoming too powerful. This system, you know, checks and balances.
Checks and balances, yeah.
Is fundamental to American governance and a core protection for individual liberty.
Let's break down each article then. What's Article 1 about? The legislative branch.
Correct. Article 1 grants legislative powers, lawmaking powers, to the U.S. Congress, which is composed of two houses, the House of Representatives and the Senate.
House and Senate.
It outlines their core responsibilities: making laws, levying taxes, coining and borrowing money, creating and supporting armies, declaring war, regulating commerce, and establishing courts below the Supreme Court.
Lots of power there.
Yes. But within Article 1, there are also important concepts like the right to due process. This is an overarching concept referring to the legal procedures you are entitled to, guaranteeing fairness in legal proceedings. It's woven throughout the Constitution, specifically referenced here and elaborated on in later amendments.
Due process, okay. And Article 1 also includes one of the most fundamental protections against arbitrary government overreach, the writ of habeas corpus. What exactly is that, and why is it so vital?
The writ of habeas corpus, found in Article 1, is a profound safeguard against arbitrary detention, really a cornerstone of liberty. Its purpose is not to determine a prisoner's guilt or innocence, but rather to confirm that their restraint is lawful and by due process.
Is the government allowed to hold you?
Exactly. The objective is to bring a party before a court or judge for release from unlawful imprisonment. The Constitution explicitly states that the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion the public safety may require it.
Only in extreme emergencies.
Right. And this right is also mirrored in the Texas Constitution and the Code of Criminal Procedure, emphasizing its importance at both federal and state levels. It means the government can't just hold you indefinitely without a legal reason.
So it's about whether the government has the right to hold you, not whether you're guilty. That's critical. And Article 1 also prohibits two very dangerous types of laws that sound like something from a tyrannical regime: bills of attainder and ex post facto laws. Can you explain those and why they're so important to prevent?
These are absolutely critical protections against government tyranny. A bill of attainder is basically a legislative declaration of guilt and punishment without a trial.
The legislature just says you're guilty.
Yes. Historically, it often led to something called corruption of blood, which meant the forfeiture of one's estate and all rights of inheritance for their heirs. It allowed the government, specifically the legislature, to bypass the judiciary entirely and condemn individuals by legislative fiat.
Scary stuff.
And an ex post facto law, on the other hand, is a law that retroactively changes the legal consequences of actions that were committed before the enactment of the law.
So you can't punish someone for something that was legal when they did it.
Exactly. Or you can't impose a harsher penalty than what was in place at the time you committed the act. These prohibitions, also reflected in the Texas Constitution and Code of Criminal Procedure, prevent the government from acting arbitrarily or vindictively and ensure legal predictability, which is vital for a just society.
Those are truly powerful protections for citizens against unfair government action. Let's move to Article 2. That's the executive branch, right? Our president and vice president.
Correct. Article 2 outlines the basic duties of the president and vice president. It defines powers like appointing ambassadors, Supreme Court judges, and other U.S. officers with Senate consent.
Okay.
Acting as commander-in-chief of the armed forces, making treaties with a two-thirds consent of the Senate, and the power to veto legislation passed by Congress.
The veto power.
It's also interesting to note that Article 2 is the most amended article of the Constitution, with amendments like the 12th, 20th, 22nd, 23rd, 24th, and 25th.
Why so many amendments?
Well, they reflect the evolving needs for the nation's leadership and selection procedures over time. Things like presidential term limits, succession, electoral college adjustments.
Oh, okay.
The purpose here was to establish a single, accountable leader for the nation, capable of making quick decisions and providing clear direction, especially in times of crisis.
And then, of course, the judicial branch, Article 3. That's where the Supreme Court comes in as the ultimate interpreter of laws.
Yes. Article 3 establishes and defines the jurisdiction of the U.S. Supreme Court. It distinguishes between original jurisdiction for very rare cases that are heard first by the Supreme Court, like disputes between states.
Right, states suing each other.
And appellate jurisdiction for the vast majority of cases that are heard only after being appealed from lower courts. It also defines the only crime explicitly mentioned in the U.S. Constitution. Treason.
Treason, wow.
This branch serves as a crucial watchdog over the government, interpreting laws and ensuring their fair application, thereby balancing the powers of the other branches and protecting our constitutional rights.
So that's the foundational structure, legislative, yep. Executive, judicial, checks and balances.
That's the framework.
But then we get to the heart of our personal freedoms, what was promised during ratification, the Bill of Rights. That's the first 10 amendments, your personal freedoms. Before we dive deep into the First Amendment, which is incredibly relevant to our discussion of public order, can you give us a quick overview of what these first 10 amendments generally cover? Just the highlights.
Absolutely. The Bill of Rights lays out a range of fundamental individual liberties that the government cannot infringe upon.
Okay.
The First Amendment covers freedom of religion, speech, press, assembly, and petition.
The big five.
Right. The Second Amendment protects the right to bear arms. The third prevents the quartering of soldiers in private homes. The fourth protects against unreasonable searches and seizures.
Search and seizure, okay.
The fifth and sixth amendments provide crucial legal procedural protections for those accused of crimes. Things like due process, protection against self-incrimination, pleading the fifth, protection against double jeopardy, and the right to a speedy and public trial with a lawyer.
Rights of the accused.
Exactly. The seventh provides the right to a jury trial in civil cases, and the eighth prohibits excessive bail, fines, and cruel and unusual punishments.
Cruel and unusual, yeah.
Finally, the Ninth and Tenth Amendments reserve rights to the people and the states, respectively, ensuring that the federal government's powers are limited and that other rights, not explicitly listed, are still protected. These are the core elements of what we often call due process, the idea that government must respect all legal rights that are owed to a person.
That's a great overview. For this deep dive, let's really zoom in on Amendment 1. This one seems to be in the news constantly, particularly when it comes to freedom of speech. What exactly does it guarantee, and how does it relate to our daily interactions in public?
Amendment 1 states, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievance.
Okay, the full text.
This guarantees you several key freedoms. The right to hold and practice your religious beliefs without government interference, to speak freely without censorship, to transmit and receive free media communications, to assemble peaceably in public or private gatherings, and to formally ask the government to correct a wrong or address a concern.
So speech, religion, press, assembly, petition.
Right. And these federal protections are also largely mirrored in the Texas Constitution and the Code of Criminal Procedure, showing a consistent commitment to these liberties at the state level.
So it sounds incredibly broad, covering a huge range of expression. But we all know that free speech isn't absolute. You can't, for example, just shout fire in a crowded theater if there isn't one.
Right. That's the classic example.
The Supreme Court has defined unprotected speech, which means speech that falls outside the First Amendment's protection. What are those crucial nuances that define where your free speech rights end and potential legal consequences begin?
This is where it gets really interesting and where the lines are often debated.
Yeah.
It's vital for citizens like you to understand these boundaries because crossing them can lead to criminal charges.
Okay.
The Supreme Court has indeed carved out several categories of speech that are not protected by the First Amendment, generally because their societal harm is seen to outweigh their expressive value.
What's the first one?
First, incitement. This is speech specifically directed toward inciting imminent lawless action.
Imminent meaning right now?
Yes, immediate. Mm. And it has to be reasonably likely to produce that immediate unlawful action. The landmark case that established this high bar was Brandenburg v. Ohio back in 1969.
Okay.
It means you can't just express an unpopular idea even forcefully. It has to be speech that directly encourages and is likely to cause immediate illegal acts. It's not about merely advocating for something in the future, but pushing for immediate unlawful behavior right now.
Got it. Imminent lawless action. What's next? Second, the fighting words doctrine. This exempts speech that directly creates a risk of violence against the speaker or includes insulting comments likely to emotionally harm reasonable listeners.
So words likely to start a fight.
Basically, yeah. This category is about speech that is so personally abusive and directly provocative that it's highly likely to result in an immediate violent reaction from the person addressed. It's not just speech you find offensive personally,
right,
but speech that, by its very nature, is designed to provoke a physical response right then and there.
So it's not just speech I find offensive, but speech that's practically guaranteed to escalate to a physical altercation or direct emotional harm. That's a critical difference.
Third, hate speech. Now, this is tricky. Generally, hate speech is protected.
Really? Even hateful stuff?
Generally, yes, unless it rises to the level of incitement or fighting words.
Ah, okay. So it has to meet those other tests. Exactly. That means it must be intended and reasonably likely to produce an imminent, violent reaction. Expressing political or social views, even highly offensive or bigoted ones, is normally protected under the First Amendment, unless it crosses that line into actively causing immediate violence. The First Amendment protects the expression of ideas, even those we vehemently disagree with, up until they become a direct call to illegal action or a direct personalized threat likely to cause immediate violence.
Okay, so the bar is high. What else isn't protected?
Fourth, defamation or fraudulent misrepresentation. This type of speech, which damages someone's reputation through false statements, defamation, or deceives for personal gain, fraud, is generally unprotected.
Lying to hurt someone or cheat them.
Right. However, there's an important nuance if the subject of the speech is a public figure.
Like a politician or celebrity.
Yes. Proving defamation requires demonstrating actual malice, meaning the statement was made with knowledge that it was false, or with reckless disregard of whether it was false or not.
Right.
This higher standard protects robust public debate about public figures.
Okay. Actual malice, and the last one.
And finally, obscenity. This refers to sexual material that appeals to a prurient interest, meaning it's capable of eliciting lustful thoughts, and it meets three specific rules as defined by the Supreme Court.
Three rules?
Yes. One, it appeals to an average person's prurient interest applying contemporary community standards. Two, it depicts or describes sexual conduct in a patently offensive way as defined by applicable state law. And three, it wholly lacks serious artistic, political, or scientific value.
Lacks any serious value. That sounds hard to meet.
It can be. Child pornography, for instance, is always considered obscene under this standard, regardless of these three factors. It has no protection.
Right, obviously.
Understanding these limits, incitement, fighting words, the narrow exception for hate speech, defamation, fraud, and obscenity is absolutely crucial because this is exactly where otherwise protected speech can become a criminal offense under state law, often falling under Texas's offenses against public order and decency.
That's a comprehensive breakdown. So how do these categories of unprotected speech, these limitations, connect directly to specific Texas laws? Because this is where the theory of free speech meets real-world consequences, especially in the Texas Penal Code's offenses against public order and decency. How does Texas law put those boundaries into practice?
This is precisely where our understanding of the Code of Criminal Procedure and the Constitution comes into practical application. Title IX of the Texas Penal Code specifically details offenses that directly relate to the boundaries of protected speech and public conduct.
Okay, Title IX, what's in there?
Let's start with disorderly conduct. This is a common Class C misdemeanor, though it can be higher in some cases. A person commits this offense if they intentionally or knowingly in a public place.
What counts as disorderly?
Several things. Using abusive, indecent, profane, or vulgar language in his utterance tends to incite an immediate breach of the peace.
So just swearing isn't enough. It has to be likely to start trouble right now.
Correct. Also, making an offensive gesture or display that tends to incite an immediate breach of the peace.
Flipping someone off, maybe?
Could be, if it's likely to cause an immediate fight. Fighting with another in a public place is also disorderly conduct.
Actual fighting, okay.
Making unreasonable noise, for example, exceeding 85 decibels after receiving a public nuisance notice from a peace officer, unless it's like a sports shooting range or near a private residence they have no right to occupy.
Loud noise.
Creating a noxious and unreasonable odor by chemical means, like releasing a stink bomb.
Stink bomb, seriously.
It's in there. Also, abusing or threatening a person in a public place in an obviously offensive manner. Though there's a defense for that one if there's significant provocation for their words or actions.
Okay, provocation matters. So just swearing isn't automatically disorderly conduct. It has to tend to incite an immediate breach of the peace. That's the key. And I see it applies to public school campuses, too.
Yes. The definition of public place for this offense specifically includes public school campuses or grounds. Now, interestingly, for certain speech-related offenses like unreasonable noise, obstructing a passageway, or funeral disruptions, there's a crucial defense when conduct consists of speech or other expression.
A defense for speech? How does that work?
If the conduct involves speech, gathering to hear speech, or nonviolent picketing, the person must be ordered to move, disperse, or remedy the violation prior to arrest, provided they haven't intentionally harmed protected interests beyond the speech itself.
So they get a warning first if it's about expression?
Generally, yes. It's a defense if no order was given, the order was unreasonable, or the order was promptly obeyed. This is a vital provision for balancing the right to free speech with the need to maintain public order.
That's a really important nuance. It gives people a chance to comply before being arrested if their conduct is speech-related. What about firearms and disorderly conduct? How do weapons factor into this?
The same section also covers firearm-related disorderly conduct. These are typically higher-grade misdemeanors, Class B instead of C.
Okay, more serious, like what?
Discharging a firearm in a public place other than a public road or a sports shooting range. There's a defense here if the person had a reasonable fear of bodily injury by a dangerous wild animal.
Shooting in public, okay.
Displaying a firearm or other deadly weapon in public in a manner calculated to alarm others. This isn't about simply carrying a weapon legally.
Right. Open carry is legal sometimes.
But doing so in a way that is clearly meant to provoke fear or alarm. Waving it around, threatening people.
Got it. Calculated to alarm.
And discharging a firearm on or across a public road, again with a defense for fear of a dangerous wild animal, or if it's a parks and wildlife employee acting within their authority.
Okay. Any other firearm specifics?
There's also a specific offense for discharge of firearm in certain municipalities, which is a Class A misdemeanor, even more serious. This applies if someone recklessly discharges a firearm inside the corporate limits of a municipality with a population of 100,000 or more.
Reckless discharge in a big city.
Right. This offense carries a higher classification due to the increased risk in denser populations.
So it's not just about what you say, but what you do, especially if it involves weapons. And what about public indecency or voyeurism? That seems like a very different category of public order offense, crossing into privacy and sexual conduct.
It is, and these sections define clear boundaries for conduct in public. It's disorderly conduct, a Class C misdemeanor. If a person intentionally or knowingly exposes their anus or genitals in public and is reckless about whether another person may be present who will be offended or alarmed by the act.
Just general public exposure.
Right. Then there's also disorderly conduct, also Class C, for peeping. This is committed when, for a lewd or unlawful purpose, someone looks through a window or other opening of a dwelling on another's property, or a guest room in a hotel, or privacy area like a restroom, shower, or changing room in a public place.
So peeking with a specific bad purpose is explicitly prohibited under disorderly conduct. What about something more serious, like voyeurism? Is that different? How?
That's where voyeurism comes in. This is a more specific and potentially more severe offense. A person commits voyeurism if, with the intent to arouse or gratify their sexual desires.
Intent matters again.
Big time.
Yeah.
They observe another person without that person's consent, while the other person is in a dwelling or structure where they have a reasonable expectation of privacy. This includes observing remotely through electronic means, like using a camera or telescope.
Wow, even with a telescope?
Yes. This is typically a Class C misdemeanor, but it escalates to a Class B with two or more prior convictions, and it becomes a state jail felony if the victim is younger than 14 years of age.
That's a significant jump in severity based on the victim's age and a specific intent. Before we go further, you mentioned sexual display definitions in the penal code. Are these important for understanding these offenses? Like, what exactly counts as sexual contact?
Absolutely. The penal code provides crucial definitions for these types of sexual offenses, so everyone's on the same page legally.
Okay.
Deviate sexual intercourse includes contact between genitals and mouth or anus, or penetration of genitals or anus with an object. Sexual contact means any touching of the anus, breast, or any part of the genitals of another person with the intent to arouse or gratify the sexual desire of any person.
Intent again.
Always key in these. And sexual intercourse means any penetration of the female sex organ by the male sex organ. These definitions are key for understanding the precise elements of the following offenses, ensuring legal clarity.
Okay, with those definitions, let's clarify indecent exposure versus that general disorderly conduct exposure we talked about. They sound similar, but it seems there's a critical difference in intent.
That's a critical distinction, and it absolutely comes down to intent. Indecent exposure is a more serious offense, Class B misdemeanor usually, than the general Class C disorderly conduct for exposure.
How so?
Here, a person commits the offense if they expose their anus or any part of their genitals with the specific intent to arouse or gratify the sexual desire of any person, and they are reckless about whether another is present who will be offended or alarmed.
So it's not just exposing, it's exposing for sexual gratification.
Exactly. The key differentiator here is that intent to arouse or gratify sexual desire. This is typically a Class B misdemeanor, but it's enhanced to a Class A with one prior conviction, a state jail felony with two or more prior convictions, and even a third-degree felony if the actor is civilly committed as a sexually violent predator.
So the intent really changes the nature of the offense, making it much more serious. What about something like public lewdness? That sounds like it involves more than just exposure.
Public lewdness involves actual sexual acts, not just exposure. A person commits this offense if they knowingly engage in sexual intercourse, deviate sexual intercourse, or sexual contact in a public place.
Doing it in public.
Or if not in a public place, they are reckless about whether another person is present who will be offended or alarmed by their act. This is a Class A misdemeanor, escalating to a third-degree felony if the actor is civilly committed as a sexually violent predator. This is about overt sexual acts in public or in private where someone could foreseeably be offended.
And then the most severe in this category, and for very obvious reasons, indecency with a child.
Yes. Indecency with a child carries significantly higher penalties due to the victim's age and vulnerability. A person commits this offense if, with a child younger than 17, and with the intent to arouse or gratify the sexual desire of any person.
Intent again.
They expose their own anus or any part of their genitals knowing the child is present, or cause the child to expose their anus or any part of their genitals. This is a third-degree felony.
Okay, very serious. Are there defenses?
There are very specific, narrow, affirmative defenses, like if the actor was not more than 3 years older than the victim and of the opposite sex, didn't use duress or force, wasn't a lifetime sex offender, or in extremely rare cases, if the actor was the spouse of the child victim. But generally, the penalties are very severe due to the profound harm and vulnerability of the victim.
Those are clearly very serious offenses with severe consequences. Beyond sexually explicit conduct, what about disrupting public events or official proceedings? We see protests all the time, for example. Where do those lines get drawn?
That brings us to disrupting meeting or procession. A person commits this Class B misdemeanor offense if, with the intent to prevent or disrupt a lawful meeting, procession, or gathering, they obstruct or interfere by physical action or verbal utterance.
Intentionally disrupting a meeting.
Right. It's about intentionally hindering a planned lawful event. Then we have hindering proceedings by disorderly conduct. This is a Class A misdemeanor, more serious.
How is that different?
An offense occurs if a person intentionally hinders an official proceeding, which is defined broadly to include administrative, executive, legislative, or judicial proceedings, even hearings before a public servant, by noise or violent or tumultuous behavior or disturbance.
Okay.
Crucially, if they recklessly hinder such a proceeding by noise or disturbance, it only becomes an offense if they continue after an explicit official request to desist.
So you get a chance to fix it if it's reckless, but if you intentionally hinder, that's immediate. And what about disrupting something as sensitive as a funeral? That seems like a very specific scenario.
That's indeed covered by funeral service disruptions. This is a Class B misdemeanor offense. It applies as if a person engages in picketing, which is defined as standing, shouting, blocking access, and so on, within the 1,000 feet of a facility or cemetery being used for a funeral service.
1,000 feet, okay.
During a specific 6-hour window, 3 hours before the service begins and 3 hours after it's completed.
A specific time and distance.
Right. This statute clearly attempts to balance protected protest rights with the need to protect sensitive events like funerals from disruption. And as we discussed with general disorderly conduct, it's also subject to that defense when conduct consists of speech provision, meaning a warning order might be required for speech-related conduct before an arrest is made.
That balancing act is really evident there, the tension between the right to protest and the right to mourn in peace. What about just blocking a sidewalk or a street, something that might seem minor but could have big impacts, like blocking traffic?
That's obstructing highway or other passageway. Without official authority, A person commits this Class B misdemeanor offense if they intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly obstruct a public passage, like a highway, street, sidewalk, railway, waterway, elevator aisle, hallway, entrance, or exit.
Mm.
Basically any place used for passage.
Okay.
Rendering it impassable or unreasonably inconvenient or hazardous.
Unreasonably inconvenient.
Yes. It also applies if they disobey a reasonable request or order from a peace officer or fireman or other authority to move or disperse to prevent obstruction or maintain public safety.
Are there enhanced penalties for that one, say, if it becomes dangerous, like with cars?
Yes, there are. It becomes a Class A misdemeanor if the person was operating a motor vehicle in a reckless driving exhibition. The burnouts, donuts, that sort of thing, often with spectators.
Street takeovers.
Could fall under this. It can escalate to a state jail felony if that reckless driving exhibition involves prior convictions, intoxication, or results in bodily injury.
Wow, felony level.
It's also a state jail felony if someone knowingly prevents the passage of an authorized emergency vehicle or obstructs access to a licensed hospital or healthcare facility for emergency medical care.
Blocking an ambulance or ER entrance? That's serious.
Very. And this offense is also subject to the defense when conduct consists of speech provision, meaning a warning order may be required if the obstruction is purely speech-related, like peaceful protesters blocking a sidewalk.
So it's not just about a temporary inconvenience. It's about public safety and access, with enhanced penalties for dangerous actions. Finally, what about riot? That sounds very serious, more than just a large crowd being loud.
Riot is indeed serious. A person commits this Class B misdemeanor offense if they knowingly participate in an assemblage of seven or more persons that meets one of three conditions.
Seven or more. Okay, what are the conditions?
One, the assembly creates an immediate danger of damage to property or injury to persons.
Danger of damage or injury.
Two, it substantially obstructs law enforcement or other governmental functions or services.
Obstructing police or government.
Or three, by force, threat of force or physical action, it deprives anyone of a legal right or disturbs the enjoyment of a legal right.
Depriving rights or disturbing enjoyment.
Right. While it's typically a Class B misdemeanor, it can become the same classification as any higher grade offense committed by a riot participant if that offense was committed in furtherance of the riot's purpose or should have been anticipated as a result of the assembly.
So if someone commits arson during a riot, others could be charged at that felony level.
Potentially, yes, if it fits the criteria. There is a defense if the assembly was initially lawful and the person retired from the assembly when the riotous intent became clear.
So it's not just a large crowd. It's a large crowd engaged in specific, dangerous, or disruptive actions that fit one of those criteria. What powers do officers have in these types of situations, especially when things get out of hand?
In cases of disorder or riot, officers have specific powers under the Code of Criminal Procedure. An officer can require aid when resisted or expecting resistance. They can command citizens of the county to assist.
Command citizens, like a form of posse.
Well, they can command them, but it's important for listeners to know that citizens actually have no legal requirement to assist.
Okay. Good clarification.
They can also, if necessary, call upon any county military company for help in seizing and arresting those in resistance. This provision really emphasizes how officers can bolster resources during large disturbances if needed.
So they can ask for help, but people aren't obligated to jump in.
That's right. Furthermore, the code outlines the duties for dispersing a riot, calling aid, and means to suppress. If seven or more people assemble and meet the penal code elements for a riot, it is the duty of every magistrate and peace officer to cause their dispersal by arresting them if needed, with or without a warrant.
They have a duty to disperse it.
Yes. Officers and those assisting them may use necessary measures, but no greater force than is requisite to accomplish that objective.
Necessary force, but not excessive force.
Exactly. And the code also clarifies that these articles for riot suppression apply equally to unlawful assemblies and disturbances defined by the penal code. There are also special constables who can be appointed by magistrates during elections and can exercise peace officer powers. These statutes collectively outline the legal framework for managing public order, illustrating the constant tension between individual expression and the collective need for public safety.
That's incredibly thorough, and it really brings the First Amendment down to the street level, explaining exactly how it functions and where the lines are drawn in Texas law. Before we go into practical scenarios, let's briefly touch on the other two foundational amendments you mentioned, the Second and Third Amendments. They might seem less frequently discussed, but they're still core to our freedoms.
Of course. Amendment 2, the right to bear arms, states, A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right to the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
Famous wording.
In its historical context, this means that in national or state emergencies, a citizen may keep and carry weapons, often thought of in terms of militia service. The Texas Constitution, in its own Bill of Rights, also addresses the right to keep and bear arms. And interestingly, Texas clarifies this right more specifically than the U.S. Constitution, often seen as providing a broader individual protection.
Right. Texas has its own take.
This right remains a very significant topic in legal and public discourse today, constantly debated and interpreted by courts.
And the Third Amendment, the one about quartering soldiers. That seems a bit, I don't know, antiquated now, doesn't it? Like something from a history book, not really relevant today.
While it might seem historical at first glance, it represents a core protection of private property and individual autonomy against government intrusion.
How so?
Amendment 3, quartering of soldiers, states, no soldier shall, in time of peace, be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner prescribed by law.
No soldiers in my house without permission.
Basically, yes. This forbids the enforced lodging of soldiers in private homes in peacetime without the owner's permission, and only permits it in wartime in accordance with established law. This directly addresses a significant grievance that contributed to the American Revolution.
Right, the British did that.
And it remains a fundamental statement about the sanctity of one's home and privacy from military imposition. The Texas Constitution also mirrors this protection, reinforcing its importance at the state level, even if it's not invoked often today.
What a journey. From the broad strokes of the Constitution to the specific rules in the Texas Penal Code and the Code of Criminal Procedure, we've covered a lot of ground. Now, let's put all this knowledge to the test and see how these laws apply in real-world scenarios. This is where we bring the rule books to life and try to understand what's actually happening on the street through the eyes of the law.
Let's do it.
All right, let's dive into some practical applications. These scenarios will help us solidify our understanding of the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure, the Penal Code, and how First Amendment rights interact with public order offenses. Let's take the first one.
A police officer patrolling a local city park at night observes a vehicle parked. The park is currently closed to the public. The officer walks over to the vehicle and observes two naked individuals inside of the vehicle engaged in sexual intercourse. What offense, if any, is occurring?
Okay, based on the elements we discussed earlier, this would clearly be an offense of public lewdness under the Texas Penal Code, section 21.07.
Public lewdness, why?
The key here is knowingly engaging in sexual intercourse in a public place. Even though the park is closed, it remains a public place for legal purposes. It's accessible to the public. Their actions are overt sexual conduct, and they're in a location where they could reasonably expect to be observed, even if no one else is currently there. They are reckless about whether others might be offended.
Got it. Public place, sexual intercourse. Clear enough. Next up.
The officer is dispatched to a local city park in reference to a subject disturbing the peace. Upon arrival, the officers observe a security guard detaining an individual. The officers learn from the security guard that the suspect, who appears drunk, ran in front of the bleachers, pulled his pants down, and exposed his anus to the crowd. What offense.
This one falls under disorderly conduct in the Penal Code, specifically section 42.01, subsection
A. The part is part.
The specific element is exposing one's anus or genitals in public and being reckless about whether another person may be present who will be offended or alarmed by the act. The park bleachers are certainly a public place where people would be present and likely offended or alarmed by such an act, regardless of whether he intended to offend. His drunkenness might explain his recklessness.
Okay, the exposure part of disorderly conduct. What about a mall altercation? We've all seen arguments escalate in public.
You have responded to the mall on a disturbance call. Upon arrival, you meet with mall security in their office where two subjects are being detained. According to witnesses, both suspects got into a physical altercation in the mall by the Santa Claus setup. An argument ensued over one suspect cutting in line. After a loud exchange of words and vulgarity by both parties, the suspects began shoving each other until separated by security. What offense or offenses?
This is a classic case of disorderly conduct under Penal Code Section 42.01, likely involving multiple parts of that statute.
Multiple parts?
Yes. First, it specifically involves fighting with another in a public place, which is subsection A6, the shoving is fighting.
Right.
Additionally, their loud exchange of words and vulgarity that tends to incite an immediate breach of the peace could also fall under subsection A1, the abusive, indecent, profane language part. The combination of the physical altercation and the provocative language clearly fits the definition of disorderly conduct.
Okay, fighting and maybe the abusive language part too. That mall fight scenario really highlights how quickly an argument can escalate to a legal issue. Let's shift gears slightly to something we see all too often on our roads.
While on duty in a marked patrol unit, you have exited the interstate and have come to a stop behind other cars, stopped for a pedestrian standing in the roadway. As you look closer, you see the man is washing the windshield for a vehicle stopped at the light. Other cars are honking for the car to move as the light has changed green. After several seconds, the man finishes cleaning the windshield and the driver of the car hands him some money. Finally, the car moves forward as several people keep honking and yelling at the man in road to get out of the way. What's the offense here?
This is an offense of obstructing highway or other passageway under the Penal Code, section 42.03.
Obstructing highway? Why?
The man is intentionally or knowingly obstructing a public street, rendering passage unreasonably inconvenient or hazardous. Even though he's providing a service, his actions are stopping the flow of traffic, preventing cars from moving on a green light, and causing inconvenience and likely hazard to other drivers. That fits the definition. It's not about his intent to do harm, but the effect of the obstruction itself.
Makes sense. Okay, this next one sounds tricky because it involves protest and free speech, an area we discussed has a lot of nuance.
You are dispatched to the local cemetery where an outdoor funeral service is being held for a military service member. About 600 feet from the service is a large group of persons protesting the military. The group is loudly shouting at the direction of the service. Some of the shouting contains offensive and vulgar comments such as, "Soldiers are government murderers for hire. Burn in hell, you piece of shit." This causes the services to be halted until the police can respond. What offense is happening?
This scenario clearly describes funeral service disruption under the Penal Code, section 42.055.
Funeral service disruption. How do we know?
The elements are met. Picketing, which includes shouting and loud comments, within 1,000 feet of a facility or cemetery being used for a funeral service. 600 feet is within 1,000. During the specified time period while the service is occurring, and crucially, causing a disruption that halted the service.
Okay, but what about free speech? They're protesting.
That's the tricky part. The key here is the potential First Amendment consideration we discussed and the specific defense in section 42.04.
Oh.
Because this involves speech-related conduct, protesting, the officer, according to that section, should have given an order to move, disperse, or remedy the violation before making an arrest, assuming the group hadn't yet intentionally harmed the interests the section seeks to protect beyond the speech itself, like physically assaulting someone.
So a warning first?
Likely, yes. However, the fact that the service was halted due to the disruption clearly indicates a harmful impact beyond just offensive speech. It interfered with the conduct of the funeral, which is exactly what the law aims to prevent. So while a warning might be required, the conduct itself seems to fit the offense.
That's where the nuance of free speech meets the need for public order and the respect for a sensitive event. Very complex. Okay, let's try this one, which involves technology and privacy.
21-year-old astronomer Buff, Telescope, lives next to a high-rise apartment complex. For sexual release, he uses his telescope to spy on other adults in the high-rise apartments. Many people forget to close their blinds or curtains, so he watches people through his telescope as they have sex or disrobe. Today, he has attached a camera recording device to his telescope and will be filming what he can find. As he scans the apartments, he catches a glimpse of a naked female closing her curtains. She does not completely close them, and from his angle, he can still see into the bedroom. He begins watching her. What offense is Telly committing?
This is a clear case of voyeurism under the Penal Code, section 21.17.
Voyeurism. What are the key elements here?
The key elements are observing another person without their consent, in a dwelling where they have a reasonable expectation of privacy, her bedroom, with the intent to arouse or gratify his sexual desires, for sexual release, the use of a telescope and camera, even remotely, fits the definition of electronic means included in the statute.
And the expectation of privacy.
The fact that the victim is in her dwelling and attempting to close the curtains strongly reinforces her reasonable expectation of privacy, which Telescope has violated with his specific sexual intent.
That's a good example of how technology can expand the reach of these offenses, illustrating that privacy boundaries extend beyond physical walls. Next up, a school disturbance.
Officers are responding to a call of a small group of students causing a disturbance outside of a high school. When the officers arrive, they find 10-15 students damaging school property, knocking out windows, spray painting, and burning books. There are teachers and campus security also present outside the school. However, they are not taking any action to stop the students. What offense is this?
This is unequivocally an offense of riot under the Penal Code, Section 42.02.
Riot. Why specifically riot?
The assembly consists of 10-15 students, which is well over the 7 or more persons threshold required for a riot.
Okay, more than 7.
And their conduct damaging school property, including knocking out windows, spray painting, and burning books, clearly creates an immediate danger of property damage. It also likely substantially obstructs governmental functions, specifically the operations of the school. This isn't just a disturbance. It fits the legal definition of a riot.
What actions should be taken here, and what powers do the officers have in this kind of situation according to the CCP?
The officers have a clear duty under CCP Article 8.04 to disperse the riot, and this includes making arrests with or without a warrant.
Duty to disperse and arrest.
Yes. They are authorized under CCP Article 8.06 to use necessary measures, but no greater force than is requisite to accomplish that objective. This means they should use the minimum force needed to stop the riot and make arrests.
Necessary force.
They can also summon aid under CCP Article 8.01, even commanding citizens, though citizens aren't obligated to assist, or calling for military aid if necessary. This should absolutely be handled the same as any other group disturbance fitting the riot definition, using the appropriate level of force and legal authority to restore order and safety.
Okay, clear procedures for handling a riot. Let's consider a really complex scenario involving public speech and potential confrontation. This feels like something you'd see go viral on social media where the lines are so blurry.
Patrol Officer Slabo is alone in his patrol car cruising a street which surrounds a public park in a suburban area. He stops to observe a long-haired, bearded person standing on a large wooden box shouting at the crowd using a battery-operated loudspeaker. The man looks to be of college age and is wearing a t-shirt from a local student activist group. The speaker is berating the government and its leaders. A crowd of 50, 75 people have gathered. The officer observes a lot of shoving by a big, burly man who has moved to the front and is heckling the speaker. This man shouts, "If you don't get that guy off his orange crate in 2 minutes, I'll shove it down his throat." He also says that the guy has been spouting off for about 20 minutes now. Let's pause here. What are the legal implications so far?
Okay, let's break this down piece by piece. The speaker's conduct, berating the government and its leaders, is generally protected speech under the First Amendment. It's political expression, even if unpopular or strongly worded.
Okay, speaker is likely protected. What about the heckler?
Now, the heckler's conduct is different. His shouting, "If you don't get that guy off his orange crate in 2 minutes, I'll shove it down his throat," could very well constitute fighting words.
Ah, fighting words.
Or potentially a terroristic threat, as it creates an immediate danger of violence. It's a direct, specific threat of physical harm that is likely to provoke a physical response from the speaker or others. That part is likely unprotected speech. Scenario 8 continued. One of the listeners from the crowd comes over to Officer Szabo and asks, "Can't you stop that big gorilla?" Officer Szabo feels that the gathering could erupt into a fight, so he warns the speaker that the crowd is getting upset and a fight could break out. He asks him to stop and break up the crowd to prevent it from turning into a brawl. The speaker ignores him, and the officer repeats his suggestion several more times, which are ignored. Officer Szabo now orders the speaker to stop and get down from the crate. The speaker tells the officer, "No, I will not." He also yells at the heckler to back off and leave me alone. The burly heckler shouts, "Get the bum!" The officer tells the speaker that he is going to have to take him into custody for his own safety and pulls him down from the crate. The speaker does not resist and is handcuffed. While being escorted to the police car, the speaker becomes very belligerent to the officer.
He calls Officer Szabo a pig and a Nazi and continues shouting, "What's happening to free speech? I've got a right to say what I think." Now, what's the analysis? Did the officer act correctly? What offenses occurred? Officer Szabo's handling of the incident is indeed complex and fraught with legal considerations, and it's a perfect example of how difficult these situations are in real time.
Yeah, it feels messy.
The speaker's initial berating of the government, as we said, remains generally protected free speech. The officer's order to stop the speaker, to prevent a brawl, needs to be evaluated against that very high, imminent lawless action standard for unprotected speech.
Right. Was the speaker inciting violence?
Exactly. The speaker's refusal to obey an order to stop might be relevant to an obstructing an officer offense if the officer's order was lawful and based on a direct threat to public safety from the speaker's own actions or speech. However, his speech itself is unlikely to be disorderly unless it genuinely incites imminent violence that he intends to cause, not just that someone else, the heckler, might cause due to being offended.
So the officer can't just stop someone because their speech is unpopular or might make someone else mad, like the heckler. It has to be a direct, immediate threat to public safety coming from the speaker's actions or words.
Precisely. The heckler's continued shouting, "Get the bum," remains highly provocative and still fits the fighting words doctrine we discussed. He's arguably the one causing the immediate breach of peace.
Okay. What about the speaker calling the officer names?
The speaker's belligerent comments while being escorted, pig, Nazi, are generally considered protected speech, as established in various court cases like Duran v. City of Douglas AZ. Verbal interference or harassment alone doesn't typically justify arrest or detention unless it violates a specific statute, like challenging to fight or physically interfering with the officer's duties.
So just being insulting isn't usually illegal?
Generally not, to an officer performing their duty. The crucial question for the officer here is whether the speaker's conduct, not the heckler's, provided a clear legal basis for arrest related to unprotected speech, like incitement or physical interference, or if the officer genuinely and reasonably believed the speaker's continued presence directly incited imminent violence from the crowd that the speaker intended beyond just strong disagreement. Arresting him for his own safety can be legally problematic if there wasn't an underlying offense committed by the speaker. This scenario highlights the extremely delicate balance between free speech and maintaining public order, and how difficult it can be for officers on the ground to make these split-second legal judgments, often focusing on the person causing the disruption rather than the person exercising protected rights.
That's a perfect example of how nuanced these situations can be, even for trained officers. It's a reminder that the First Amendment isn't just theory, it's very real in public interactions. Let's tackle a multi-part scenario, this time at a movie theater, maybe a midnight showing.
During a late-night showing of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, attended by about 50 local high school students at the local theater, Willie Weigel is dared by his friends to streak naked through the theater. Willie takes the dare and runs naked in front of the movie screen. The crowd cheers and laughs. None of the chaperones for the event were able to see what Willie did, and no one tells them. One, what offense did Willie commit?
Okay, for Willie streaking, this is disorderly conduct under Penal Code Section 42.01A10.
Disorderly conduct exposure again, why?
He exposed his anus or genitals in public, in front of the movie screen within the theater, and was reckless about whether another person might be present who will be offended or alarmed. Even if the immediate crowd cheered, the theater is a public place and he was reckless regarding the larger public or others who might be present, like chaperones, other patrons, who could find it offensive. It's not about whether everyone was offended, but whether it was reckless regarding the potential for offense. Scenario 9, Part 2. Willie then goes to the bathroom to get dressed. He then sneaks into the girls' bathroom and hides in one of the stalls. Next, he stands on top of the toilet to peek over the stall to see girls changing out of their show costumes. 2. About this part. This is clearly voyeurism under Penal Code Section 21.1 Cenum.
Voyeurism.
Mm-hmm.
Why not just disorderly conduct peeping?
It fits voyeurism better because he is observing another person without their consent in an area designed for privacy, the bathroom stall, likely with the intent to arouse or gratify his sexual desires given the context. The act of peeking over the stall, especially into a changing area with that likely intent, directly fits the definition. While it could potentially be disorderly conduct 42.01A11, peeping for a lewd purpose, voyeurism is more specific and potentially more severe, focusing on the sexual gratification aspect. Scenario 9, Part 3. Also at the event is Simon Says. During an intermission, Simon notices a pretty girl, Jessica Wabbit, in line at the concession stand. Simon walks up to her and says, "What is your name, sweetie? Sure, hot and sexy." Jessica tells Simon thanks, but tells him that she has a boyfriend. Simon smiles and says, "I like your curvy hips and those skinny thighs. I bet I can please you better than any guy you've ever met." Annoyed and offended, she tells him, "Please leave me alone. My boyfriend is right over there." 3. What about Simon's comments so far? Simon's initial comments, while undoubtedly rude, unwelcome, and offensive to Jessica, are likely still protected speech at this point.
Still protected.
Yeah,
even though they're gross.
Yeah. They do not clearly meet the high bar for incitement, fighting words or obscenity as legally defined. He's not making direct physical threats, nor is he causing an immediate breach of the peace that escalates beyond verbal annoyance or offensive language that isn't directly threatening violence right now. It's crude and unwanted, but probably not yet criminal under these specific public order statutes. Scenario 9, part 4. Simon then says, I got 10 inches just for you right here, as he grabs his crouch area, and I want those sexy legs over my shoulders tonight. Jessica starts crying and runs out of the line to report Simon's behavior. 4, now what? Now, Simon's conduct has absolutely crossed the line into indecent exposure under Penal Code Section 21.08.
Indecent exposure.
By making an explicit sexual comment and grabbing his crotch area, he is exposing or drawing attention to his genitals with the specific intent to arouse or gratify sexual desire, and he is reckless about whether another will be offended or alarmed, which Jessica clearly is. This action, combined with the explicit sexual solicitation, falls into the category of unprotected speech and conduct due to the overt sexual intent and the offensive manner of expression. Scenario 9, Part 5. When intermission ends and the movie performance restarts, the manager, chaperone, confronts Simon about what he said to Jessica. Simon gets mad, turns over several tables with displays, and runs inside the movie area. Chap stops the movie and turns on the lights so he can find Simon. Once located and told to leave the event, Simon yells several profanities to Chap in the crowd, who is yelling at him to get out of the way. 5. And finally, Simon's reaction. Simon's actions here would likely lead to multiple offenses. First, turning over tables and blocking passage by running into the movie area, especially with others yelling for him to get out of the way, could be obstructing highway or other passageway under Section 42.03, as he's rendering a public passage, aisles, walkways, and the theater, unreasonably inconvenient or hazardous.
Obstruction. Okay. What else?
Second, his yelling of profanities to the manager and the crowd, especially with the crowd's reaction of yelling back, could be disorderly conduct under Section 42.01(a)(1) for using abusive, profane, or vulgar language that tends to incite an immediate breach of the peace. The crowd's reaction indicates the potential for escalating disruption. He might even be bordering on inciting a riot, depending on how things develop.
That escalated quickly. It's amazing how a seemingly trivial dispute can spiral into multiple criminal offenses. One final scenario, this time involving noise in official proceedings.
During a criminal trial, Judge Mac M. Pei stops the proceeding because of some construction noise. The judge sends the court officer, Bailey Lift, to check on the noise. Bailey finds two construction workers, Will Barrow and Bill Board, in the room next door, hard at work. They stop their sawing and hammering when they see Bailey. Bailey tells them that they have disturbed the court hearing, and they explain they are behind in the renovation project of the courthouse. Will and Bill tell him they're working past their normal stopping time of 7 a.m. to catch up and didn't think anyone would hear them. 1. Have they committed an offense yet?
At this point, probably no offense has been committed. The workers immediately stop when confronted, and they explain the situation. There's no indication of intent to hinder or reckless behavior continuing after an explicit request to desist, which is critical for these types of offenses. They simply weren't aware they were causing a problem. Scenario 10, Part 2. Bailey tells them that they must stop, but they inform him they cannot because they could lose the contract if they don't catch up. Bill and Will say that they will be as quiet as they can. They continue working, and Bailey goes back to the courtroom. He explains to Judge Mac M. Pei what he was told. The judge shakes his head in disgust. As soon as the court gets back in session, the saw next door winds up and loud banging begins. The judge can't hear and must stop court again. 2. Now what? Now, an offense has indeed been committed. Hindering proceedings by disorderly conduct under Penal Code Section 38.13.
Hindering proceedings? Why now?
The workers recklessly hindered an official proceeding, the court trial by noise, and crucially, they continue their noisy activity after an explicit official request to desist from Bailey Lift, the court officer.
They were told to stop, but kept going.
Exactly. Their explanation about the contract doesn't negate the offense once they continued after being told to stop and the disturbance resumed, impacting the official proceeding. This highlights that once an official order is given to cease disruptive behavior impacting a proceeding, continuing that behavior becomes a criminal act, regardless of their motivations.
These scenarios really drive home how these detailed legal principles play out in daily life. It puts the how of the CCP and the what of the penal code, plus the limits of the Constitution, into clear perspective.
Absolutely. Seeing it in action makes it much easier to grasp. Hashtag, hashtag, tag outro.
Well, that was a truly enlightening deep dive. We've journeyed from the historical foundations of our nation's legal system, exploring why the U.S. Constitution and its Bill of Rights were established.
Yeah, going way back.
To understanding the specific operational manual for criminal justice in Texas, the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure, the CCP. We've broken down who counts as a peace officer, which, as we learned, is far, far broader than many might assume.
Definitely broader.
And explored the nuances of their powers and limitations.
And we didn't stop there. We delved into the crucial distinctions between the what of crimes in the penal code and the how of enforcement in the Code of Criminal Procedure. Most importantly, we dissected your fundamental First Amendment freedoms, especially freedom of speech.
Right, the big one.
And examined where those rights find their limits in specific Texas Penal Code offenses related to public order and decency. Through those practical scenarios, we saw how these theoretical concepts apply to real-world situations, helping you identify everything from various forms of disorderly conduct to voyeurism and riots.
Our goal today was really to empower you with essential knowledge about your rights, who has authority, and how legal concepts translate into real-world scenarios you might encounter. Understanding these rule books of our society isn't just for legal professionals. It's truly essential for every curious citizen to navigate the world with greater awareness and confidence.
Indeed. And it leaves us with maybe a final provocative thought to chew on. The delicate balance between individual rights, like free speech, and the collective need for public order and safety is constantly being tested and redefined in our society.
It really is.
In a world with increasing opportunities for both expression and disruption, thanks to technology and everything else, how do you think society should navigate the tensions that arise when these fundamental principles collide? Where do we draw the line between protected expression and criminal conduct, and why is that line so challenging to define and maintain in our everyday lives?
That's a question for all of us to ponder as informed citizens. We encourage you to continue exploring these topics. Perhaps look up more specific ordinances in your local area or follow landmark court cases that continue to challenge and redefine these legal boundaries. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the rule books of rights and justice.
Thanks for listening.
We hope you feel more informed and empowered. See you next time on The Deep Dive.